This episode of the Sportsman's Empire is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. Since 1952, Interstate Batteries has been evoking compassion and a trustworthy spirit into the surrounding communities. Interstate Batteries is a mission-driven company fueled by purpose and guided by their values. If you need help locating a specific battery, stop into your local Interstate Batteries retail store and speak with a battery specialist. They even offer cell phone repairs. Interstate Batteries. Outrageously dependable. All right, everybody, back again here at the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. Thank you guys very much for tuning into this every week. I really do appreciate it. I still cannot believe that I do this for a living, and I get to come upstairs into this little office that I've made, sit down and talk about deer hunting for hours on end, or Western hunting or fishing or the outdoors or anything like that. So, dude, I'm feeling very hashtag blessed today for some reason. And today we have a returning guest. Is this your first time on the Nine Finger Chronicles though, right?
Yep. This is okay. The first time on this podcast.
Mr. Aaron Berg, how we doing, dude?
Dude, doing great. It's rainy and horrifying outside, so I'm happy to be sitting in here with you.
Yeah, I should check the radar because we have some outside activities to do at some point today, and I want to try to get them done before the rain creeps in because we're supposed to get rain. It's cloudy here and whatnot. But I want to kick things off with a question, and maybe it's because I'm getting old and probably at the very beginning of Alzheimer's or dementia or something like that. What has been the last thing that you've lost? And you can't find it. You look everywhere for it. You thought it was in a place and it's not there and you can't find it.
I mean, I have a lucky hat that I wear pretty much every time I go fishing. And I lose it almost every time I go.
Nice.
I had a mini heart attack last night thinking about it and I had to go into the hunting room and dig through everything to find it. And I mean, it was a heart sinking feeling for about 15 minutes.
Okay. That brings up a great point. Lucky hats. That's a real thing for men. And I have this hat that I've had, and like, crazy enough, I bought it at Target, like, I want to say over 10 years ago. It's been a long time. And it's like a Fidel Castro hat. It's got like a short bill, looks kind of military-ish. And I've had that same hat now for all of my Western hunts. I've had that same hat for like, I want to say 10 plus whitetail seasons probably. And I absolutely love that hat. And it's starting to deteriorate to the point where like I might need to go try to find another hat, but I only want that particular hat. And I, even when I go online and using like the AI of today where take a picture of the hat and go and try to find it somewhere, I can't find it anywhere. So. That's a big problem for me because I love that hat. What happens when it wears out and I can't wear it anymore?
Yeah. I mean, your wife's just going to look at you worse and worse, the uglier it gets. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no elastic left in mine. It's a beanie hat. And like I wore it on a tournament last year and it was raining the entire time. And there's just like dirty water, sweat pouring out of this hat, and, like staining my shirt. I'm like, it's the grossest thing that I own, but I mean, I think I got it in like 2016. So it's like, I cannot not have that one.
Exactly. I wish I had it up here. It's in my truck. I don't ever want it to leave my truck because anytime I go out on a shed hunt, I do any type of like deer activities, I put this little hat on. And I don't know what it is about things like that that just make me feel better. I don't know what it is, but like, I don't know. Do women have a version of that? Do women have like, oh, I have to have this purse or I have to wear these pair of shoes because I wear these pair of shoes all the time? Like, we have hats.
I feel like they have water bottles now.
Mm.
Like, I don't know if your wife is the same as mine, where it's just like this giant jug of water that she carries around everywhere.
Yep. She has something like that, especially where she goes to when she goes to the gym. She's got that, but she doesn't carry it around everywhere she goes. I don't know. How many hats do you own? That's the next question.
Dozens.
Yeah. Here's what pisses my wife off. We have this bedpost on our bed, on the headboard, and I put all of my hats on that and I stack them up. So there's like 15 hats and then I have another 15 because, you know, like all the sponsors, they send me hats. All like people who want to work with me send me hats. Anytime I go to a trade show, hey, Dan, here, take one of our hats. I'm like, okay, cool, man. I got a lot of hats, but I only wear like maybe six of them. Six hats. How many of all your hats? How many hats do you actually wear? Five. And what are, can you name them?
They stay on a stack next to the bed, kind of the same as yours, but you know, you got the little bedside counter there. And like, I just have my stack of hats. You got to pick the right one for the day. Mm-hmm. If you're working or flying a drone or going deer hunting or whatever, like you have your right hat for each moment.
Exactly. And what hats are those? Can you explain what hats you have? Like what?
I have one beanie. I've got my company hat, my work hat. I think I got a Stone Glacier one that's got more sweat than I want to talk about.
Yeah. Yep. Let's see. I have my, this hat now has made it into the rotation. I like the looks of it. I have a St. Louis Cardinals baseball hat that I've had for years. I have basically a school system hat. So we're the Prairie Hawks. So I have a Prairie Hawks hat that I wear to all the events. I have the Nine Finger Chronicles hat has been around forever. And then what other hat do I wear the most? Vortex Optics. I have a couple Vortex Optics hats that are in the rotation, and that's what I wear, dude. That's what I wear. And obviously the hunting hat, but that only comes out during hunting seasons and doing hunting things. So yeah. Okay. I'm glad you said you lost your favorite hat. I lost a GoPro. I swear to God, I put it up in my office here and now I can't find it. So two things happened. I actually lost it. Don't know where it's at, or the kids have done something to it and I'm pissed because I can't find it. And they, you know, of course they're not going to tell me where it's at. So I might have to go buy a new GoPro, which is not cheap. So before we get into whatever it is we're going to talk about, not sure yet, I'm going to send a huge shout out to all of the partners of the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast. If, in my opinion, if you're looking for I haven't said this out loud in a while, and I think I should. If you're looking for the most heavy metal rock and roll style of broadhead, go check out Wasp Archery. Most of their heads are still manufactured in the United States. Awesome material made from really good people, designed by really good people. The functionality of them is awesome, and whatever they hit, they destroy. So go check out wasparchery.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list is Vortex Optics. Turkey season's over, so maybe I don't talk about the red dots on your turkey shotgun right now, but what I will talk about is spotting scopes and binoculars. I mean, I could sit here and talk to you about what my favorite, you know, category is of those products, but it's gravel travel season for me right now. So the beans are starting to come up. Me and my boy, we were coming home from a baseball game last night and we saw a velvet buck out in the field. He was pretty small, but still, it's velvet gravel travel season. So grab a Vortex binocular, grab a Vortex spotting scope, go out and try to locate something, dude. It's so much fun with the kids. So vortexoptics.com. The next one on the list is Code Blue Scents, real and synthetic deer urines, scent elimination products, the Rope-A-Dope mock scrape kit, and just a really awesome company that provides some really cool products for you to either smell different, you know, attractants to bring them in, or pair a Rope-A-Dope mock scrape kit with the next company that I want to talk about, and just like be able to identify deer, be able to invoice deer, or not invoice, what's the word I'm looking for? When you're documenting them, I don't know. When you're trying to see how many deer are on your property and what deer are on your property, that's why I love using the mock scrape. So codebluescents.com, discount code NFC20 for 20% off of all their products. Next on the list is Reveal Trail Cameras. These guys are coming out, I believe, in August. Stand by, because they're coming out with some new cameras, new power systems, some really cool things that are going to be happening. I can't go into detail now about that, but stand by because there's some really cool things coming. If you need a trail camera right now, go to tacticam.com/cameras and take a look at all of the products that they offer, and go to any app and download the Reveal app. So, and then last but not least, go check out my company, FullSneakGear.com. We do have two new partners, I believe two new partners. As of right now, one for sure. Just trying to finish all of the boring contract stuff for the other one, but two new products, two new brands that are going to be joining us next year, which is kind of cool. Two products that I've been using for a very long time, and I'm excited to share that. All right, FullSneakGear.com. That's my brand. I think we're done. All right, let's get into this today. You live in Southeast Wisconsin, you said, right?
Yep. So about 15 miles north of Milwaukee.
Is Milwaukee close enough to Chicago where there's like a train that runs from Milwaukee to Chicago every day? Like, is that too far away?
It's like 60 miles.
Okay, 60 miles.
Yeah.
Dude, I know people who are in traffic for an hour and a half, maybe 2 hours every single day, one way to get to their job. I don't know if it's necessarily as bad as it was before COVID, you know, but after COVID, you know, there. So does Milwaukee get like the Chicago hangover, like all of the other like bigger cities around in the suburbs of Chicago, or not?
No, not too really. Far away? Okay. Yeah, it's a little too far for that. You know, there's so many suburbs around Chicago that they stay in their state.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your, when you go into Milwaukee, what's your favorite thing to do in Milwaukee?
They've got a great food scene. Like I went to culinary school and worked in restaurants for a long time. So like food is important to me. So being able to be close enough to a place that has thousands of different restaurants is really nice.
Love it. What's your favorite restaurant to go to in Milwaukee?
Couldn't even pick one, honestly. There's so many options to choose from down there where it is really nice. I've got some buddies from culinary school that work at a restaurant called Morel.
Okay.
And I like that for obvious reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So next time you're in Milwaukee, go check out that restaurant if you're ever in Milwaukee. I've been to Milwaukee a couple times, dude. It's a cool city. Here's what I'll say. The last time I was in Milwaukee, several years ago, I thought we were going to go to a baseball game. We did not go to a baseball game. Instead, we went to a bar and did like lots of shots of Jägermeister and then woke up in a hotel room the next morning. So we got in late, we partied hard, then we went to bed. That's all I really know of Milwaukee. I don't know.
That's a pretty standard Milwaukee trip. I promise you're not the only one.
You've heard that before. Go to Milwaukee, black out, and wake up and leave. So there you go. Okay. So how far do you live from Milwaukee?
About 15 miles.
Okay. 50 miles. So I'm looking at a map right now, and I know it's not as big or as broad as Chicago, but it's still a big city. It still has all these little suburbs surrounding it. What is the hunting scene like that close to a bigger city with a whole bunch of like smaller suburbs and little cities all around it?
You have lots of small pieces, at least up where I am. You have tons of stuff that's in that 40 to 200 acre sections. Mm-hmm. And then there's some bigger sections that are mainly just swamplands up here.
Gotcha. And so how far west, or like how far do you have to travel from where you live to your hunting properties?
I mean, I've got one that's 10 minutes from my house, but most of the spots that I'm hunting now are hour. So it takes some doing to do an all day sit or a morning sit when you've got a 2 hour drive to start the day.
Oh yeah, dude. Well, I don't know. I'm not an all day guy, but what I do is I get out, I run into town, I'll do something, or go back to a campsite or go back to the house, do some work. But if you're that far away from home and, you know, you start the day off with a 2 hour drive just to get to a hunting property, and you might as well sit all day at that point. You know what I mean? Because what else are you going to do? I mean, unless the wind changes or some things like that, but still for me, that would be really hard.
Yeah, because I mean, you've got, you know, the 2 hour drive in the morning, you've got an hour plus walk into a lot of the stuff that I'm hunting in where, you know, you're wearing chest waders in and walking forever. And by the time you get in there, it's like, well, I don't want to walk an hour out and then drive 20 minutes to the next town and go eat food or take a nap or whatever. It's like, yeah, you might as well just hunker in and just call it a day.
Yeah. Do a lot of people do that? I mean, as far as, because you're in a bigger, heavy populated area, do a lot of people still drive? And so it's like you're trying to avoid the pressure, but still you're running into pressure because so many other people are doing it.
I mean, the closer you are to the city, the more pressure you have. You know, I spend most of my time in the bigger swamps and, you know, somewhere that I have to boat into or wade into. So, I mean, you get away from most of the pressure that way. But it's actually been kind of funny lately. The last few years, you know, when you're looking at a map, you're finding these little Oak Islands or whatever back in these swamps. It seems like the farther you get into the swamp, the more sign I'm starting to see. And I don't know if that's because people have listened to guys like you or Dan Infault or Andy May, where it's, you know, go deep, yeah, go hard every time. Where like, if you have an island a mile back in a swamp, there'll be two trail cameras. If you have an island that's 3 miles into a swamp, there'll be half a dozen.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing. People don't have to go back there all the time now. I think when these conversations initially started, that was right around the birth of cellular trail cameras, right? And so now all you have to do is walk in one time and put up a trail camera, and then you just kind of wait to see what shows up. And that, granted, it's not telling you everything, but what it is telling you is, either are there other people there? Is there a big buck in there that I want to go chase? And if you position your trail camera right, I'm guessing that it does a lot of the work for you, especially in a concentrated like Oak Island where, you know, there's probably one trail leading into it or a couple trails or a couple beds that these guys are positioning their cameras on. So all they don't have to walk in there one, like every weekend or every time they hunt. They just monitor for the best possible times and then they pull the trigger on it when it's time to go.
And I mean, that's exactly what I do. I mean, most of the time when I'm setting trail cameras, like I set and redo batteries generally once a year, and I do it in March every year. Like the snow's melted, but the swamps are still frozen enough where I can walk back, put in new batteries, and literally just monitor those spots. Because again, they're so far away from the house. Yeah, you can't go out there every couple of weeks to, you know, pull a card or change batteries or whatever. So, you know, you just, you have to time it right to get in there. And yeah, I very, very seldomly ever have people on my trail cameras now.
Yeah, man, I think what's happening is when a trend like that happens, right, everybody's like, go deep, go deep, go deep, go deep, and you start to run into more sign from people, then you have to be creative and be like, the deer are going to do the same thing. They're going to just find, they're not going to travel that, or they're going to get pushed onto private, or they're going to just like notice the trend and adjust theirs closer to a road or closer to a parking lot or whatever the case is. And so if everybody's going deep, the new trend is going to be, hey, dude, I'm hunting right off the road. You'll hear about 10 or 15 guys connect on a strategy like that. Then the next hot strategy people talk about is how close to the road or to the parking lot that they're hunting, because there's so much pressure deep into the swamp.
Yeah, exactly. And my brother actually has a spot like that now where, you know, it's a big parking area, a giant trail that goes into this like 1,000-acre piece. And I mean, he can hear the car door shutting in his spot. Now he walks 40 yards down the trail, takes a right and walks up the hill. And I mean, there's deer everywhere in there. But every single person that hunts that piece walks this main trail out of the parking area. And yeah, I mean, he can literally hear his car beep. He can lock his truck from his tree stand.
Well, that's nuts, man. Hey, man, I had a tree stand once where, and I still have it, I just haven't hunted it, but it was like in this little pinch behind a house. And I can see the farmer get up in the morning and through the kitchen window and fill his coffee pot up and then start making coffee. And in about 20 minutes, I can smell coffee aroma coming from their house. That's how close I was. And some really
big... That would be miserable.
Yeah, some really big deer would come through that. Some really big deer would come through that. And so I would always have that particular trail camera in that pinch, and it would tell me, for some reason, that was my holy grail for when it was time to start hitting it hard. Because for some reason, the first big mature buck every year would daylight in that pinch, either at like first sunrise or, you know, 20 minutes before sunset. And I would always hunt that little spot first, but then they did some like like timber stand improvement, and they changed it. Something happened, right? When I think of a swamp, I think of alligators in Louisiana, and I think of chest high water, things like that. Describe what you mean from a Wisconsin swamp.
So big, big cattail marshes, tamarack, cedar swamps, where it's just impenetrably thick on the edges. And once you get into the center of them, it's just a sea of cattails or marsh grass, mm-hmm. and, anywhere from ankle to waist deep water.
Okay. And then how do you hunt that? How do you scout that? How do you even get into those? Or do you have to be in waders or knee boots all the time?
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, it's very, very seldom that I get to go to a spot where I don't at least have hip boots on, if not chest waders. And like I said, I like boating into places. I like grabbing the canoe and going in. Also love anywhere that has a creek bed that I can walk through, whether it's knee deep or waist deep. If you can get into a creek bed and walk downstream to your stand, I mean, you are a ghost getting into those spots. Like the scent blows straight down. You don't make any noise.
Mm-hmm. The scent usually follows the river current too. It's not like getting blown for the most part into the, into the timber that you're, I tell you what, some of the best access routes I've ever walked have been water drainages or creeks or river banks where it's just, if I walked it, it'd be over my head, but I just hug the bank and get to the spot and pop up right up on a tree, and I'm sitting right on the bank. Dude, some of those spots are money, especially if you can get in there on the right wind or even in a wind where for me, it's blowing into the timber, but not parallel with the waterway. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So like the deer they're traveling the waterway. There's like a trail right in there, right along the waterway. And so at some point, if they walk by me, they would potentially catch my scent, but hopefully it's going over their backs. Does that make sense? Yeah. So I've hunted spots like that quite a bit. And I love river bottom, creek bottom, like thick, nasty spots like
that. Yeah. And I mean, a lot of the swamps and marshes that I hunt, like that creek bottom is where all of the brush is, everywhere else is swamp grass and stuff. And you get to those creek bottoms and you actually have some alders and, mm-hmm. Just that real thick bedding cover. And I mean, you can walk through bedding cover in a river and not spook all the deer out. Cause I mean, they feel safe there.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And they, if they can't smell you, they don't really know what you are. It's so thick that you can hear the deer making noise when they're walking through it. So they have no idea what you are unless you're talking, right? So with it being so thick and nasty and just difficult to get back there. I mean, for me, I have a couple spots where I can get out of my truck. I can walk down a hill and I'm in an awesome spot, right? I'm maybe 300, 400 yards from the tree stand. Easy walk, right? The hardest part is walking back up the hill on the way to my truck. But you guys are putting, like my buddy Curtis back in the day, I'm sure he still does, but he was a gangster up in Wisconsin and he would hunt a lot of these cattail swamps as well. And just watching the videos that he would show me of him getting in and out were extremely difficult, right? Just like, I don't even know. I'd be like, damn, this sucks. This would suck for the average Joe. But going that extra mile, is it really worth it? Are you seeing bigger, higher end quality deer all the way back there? All right, guys, you know me and I love eating wild game, but I don't eat wild game every single night. Every once in a while, I'll reach for a side of beef, and that's why I trust Omaha Steaks. Because Omaha Steaks are sent directly to my door, I can keep my freezer stocked without having to go to the grocery store. It's honestly like having a trusted butcher and gourmet food shop right at your house. Last week, I pulled out their pure ground ribeye burgers for a quick grill session. The flavor and marbling was unreal, rich, juicy, and miles ahead of any average grocery store meat. Try the burger perfection flight at omahasteaks.com today. That's 20 premium steak burgers for just $79.99. Plus, get $35 off with promo code BEEF. That's omahasteaks.com. Promo code BEEF for $35 off at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. I've been trying Underbrush from Nathan and Sons, and it's not really regular gum. It's remineralizing chewing gum, basically an oral care routine in gum form. You brush in the morning and at night, but after lunch, there's a big gap where most of us do nothing for our teeth. Underbrush is made for that moment. Chew it for 5 to 10 minutes, spit it out, and move on. Or keep chewing it if you like the feel of it. It's made with something called hydroxyapatite. That's the same mineral your enamel is made from, and natural saps like mastic and spruce. So it has a firmer, really satisfying chew. The company is only a few years old, and the team is literally making, packing, and shipping gum every day. So if you want a simple daily upgrade for your teeth, check out Underbrush from Nathan & Sons. Check them out today at nathanandsons.com.
Yes.
Yeah.
For the most part, mm-hmm. Yeah. That's the beauty of having cell cams now, is you can get back into these nasty hell holes, put a camera up, and let it soak for a year. And you get everything that you need out of it, where you can go back when it's frozen and easy to walk to. And I've got plenty of spots where I'm walking in and I'm like, I don't know if I can physically get back here when it's not frozen. But if there's a giant on camera, I'll figure out a way.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm kind of curious, when you're walking back there or you're getting back there and you're in hip boots and hip waders, are you bringing extra clothing and gear or boots and gear so that once you get to a spot, then you change your clothes because of being wet, or you change your hip waders into a pair of hiking boots, or are you sitting in hip waders the entire time?
Generally, I'm sitting in waders the entire time. I might change that this year. Last year, it screwed up a hunt for me a little bit because I was in chest waders with felt sole boots on.
Mm-hmm.
Just because it was a long walk and I didn't want to be in neoprenes and I didn't want to be in, cheap rubbers that are freezing cold.
Right.
But it was also, November 4th and 9 degrees out. And turns out that felt sole boots freeze to your tree stand in the mornings.
Shit.
Every time you try and adjust your weight or move your feet, it's cracking ice. So you literally cannot move. And I'm hunting out of a saddle and I have one stick up and it's like, I need to be able to have some sort of movement. I had a tough shot last year on a buck, and it was simply because I couldn't move my feet. Once I saw it, I was like, I know how noisy this thing is right now. So I have to go over the bridge and try and do a downward shot on the weak side. It was just a nightmare.
Yeah, those shots suck, dude. Weak side. When you say weak side, you mean your drawing arm, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, dude. That was my biggest problem for a while, was trying to convince myself to use a saddle because of one reason. What happens if something comes to your draw side arm quickly? Comes up from the, for me, it would be my right side, behind me, right side. You know how much movement I have to do to quickly get around for a shot opportunity like that? And I know there's a lot of saddle hunters out there that are going, wait a second, you're just doing it wrong. You got to do, I don't give a shit, dude. You're doing a lot of moving in the tree to get to that next position, right? And hopefully you don't have to, and you set your saddle up right so they come to your strong side arm. But that was my biggest, that's where I was the biggest skeptic for saddles for years.
Yeah. And I might be doing it wrong.
Yeah. Oh, I could be. Yeah. I could 100% be doing it wrong. So you said one stick. Mm-hmm. How high in these marshes, how high are you getting?
Most of the time you don't have to get that high. A lot of the trees that I'm climbing are dead in the first place. Mm-hmm. So just out of self-preservation, I'm trying to not go up super high. But the nice part with one sticking is I can go as high as I need. I've got a 40-foot rappel rope with me. So I can get up there if I have to. But most of the time, you're 15-ish feet off the ground only, because otherwise you're just out in the open on a dead tree. Like, they could see you.
Yeah. And so, in a scenario like that, I'm envisioning a couple dead trees. Maybe you're on an oak island. Are you ever in a position to where you're above the cattails and you're able to scan the cattails with a pair of binoculars or something? Or do these deer just materialize? And what I mean by that is, Are they showing up within shooting range? Just like, boom, they're there. We got to make a move now type of deal.
You have one of two options. Generally, it's they show up and they're at 30 yards and you're going, holy shit, I need to turn and shoot. Mm-hmm. Or you see them at 300 and then you don't see them again until they're at 30 yards.
Okay. Gotcha. Gotcha. And what does the rut look like at that point? And so I'm envisioning the does are somewhere else, but the big bucks are back there because of security. And then what happens during the rut? Are there does back in there too the whole year? What are they eating? What's their food to bed routine look like in a really wet environment like that?
Yeah, that's why I try and focus on the islands. You know, you'll generally have these small islands and then strips of timber along the creek channels or these wetter areas that you can focus on. But it seems like the does like to bed the edges of those islands, and those bucks will just run in between those islands during the rut.
Yeah. Yeah. And so are there like noticeable paths through the swamp that these deer are taking? And then does that allow you to use those same paths to get to where these islands are at?
Yeah. Generally, it looks like a cow path running through between the islands. And to the point, generally, you're able to see them on Onyx even.
Yeah. And that's where this was a while ago. I was talking to some guys who hunt those swamps, and they're like, dude, it's not easy to find it's not hard to find the trails. All you have to do is look at any digital map and zoom in, and you can see where they're walking. And usually what happens is that leads to some kind of point somewhere. And then that is where you need to set up. So the point being like one of those islands or one of those dead trees, bunches of dead trees, or a little bit of an elevation where these deer are living and things like that. What are they eating out there?
A lot are focusing on acorns out there.
Okay.
You know, trying to find the oaks. But most of these big swamps, they're surrounded by private ag.
Okay.
So okay. You're able to find these points that are coming off of private ag fields and they're going back to bed in those big marshes. But that's also nice for a morning access. You know, you can get into these points that are 300 or 400 yards from where they're feeding in the morning. So, you can crash through the cattails and break through ice without worrying about bumping all the deer out, because they're hundreds of yards away in ag, and they're going to, first show up at your tree stand at 9 a.m.
Right, right. And so is it easier to hunt these locations in the mornings or in the afternoons?
I think you almost have to hunt them in the mornings. Yeah, it sucks to walk in the dark. I don't like it. You trip on everything, but
they're not there, right?
Right. They're not there. It doesn't matter. You go in the afternoon and you blow deer out every time you get close to an island. Like you're 50 yards from the tree you want to set up in. And by the time you get to your tree, you've bumped four does out. And it's like, well, guess I can probably just turn around now.
Yeah. Yeah. And so if that's your hunting style, what do you do for afternoon hunts then? Are you hunting closer to the ag then and trying to catch them coming out of the marsh?
Generally, if I just have an afternoon to hunt, I'm either going to a spot where I can boat in and just get right into a tree where I'm not busting through a bunch of stuff, or I'm just avoiding those big marshes and I'll hunt something, closer to home for an afternoon hunt. But if I have the time to get out in the mornings, then that's when I'm going on those big walks.
Gotcha. I had a guy, I think it was like the first year of podcasting, and I have since talked to a lot of people about the same method using boats. And boats are kind of like cars. They just don't, there's so many of them so often, the noise doesn't bother them. It's like farm equipment, right? It's like an active farm and deer bedding like in the windbreak of an active farm and things like that. Does your boat allow you to get really close to them?
Say boat, it's a canoe.
Yeah. Canoe, boat, okay, no motor on it.
Yeah, last year I was hunting a pretty good deer down in the Milwaukee area and was able to boat in, get the canoe tucked in, and after 15 yards heard him coming through the cattails. And he came to 10 yards and got downwind of me. I could see his antler tips, but I couldn't see his body yet.
You weren't in the tree yet when it happened?
No, I was 15 yards from my canoe only.
Shit. Man, that sucks.
Yeah. I mean, this was a, you know, probably a 4.5 or a 5.5 year old deer that I was after. And yeah, I was able to get out of the canoe, get everything set, get my pack on and, you know, sneak 15 yards. And yeah, I mean, he was within 20 yards of me the entire time.
And this was a deer that you knew about and you were hunting him specifically?
Yep.
Yeah. Talk to me a little. A
big mainframe 8 with split G2s on both sides.
Shit.
A real one. One that you don't generally see on public.
Yeah. Talk to me about what a deer of that caliber hypothetically sees in a given year as far as hunting pressure. Like what, how do you feel? Because I talked to another guy, he shot a 14-year-old buck in Wisconsin on public land. Like that blows my mind. He's like, the opening day of firearm season, he counted like 50 trucks. There was 50 trucks on this giant block of public, and he ended up shooting this buck. That means that this deer survived X number of years, all those years, slipping through the cracks of that high of hunting pressure, and he still made it. What do you think the hunting pressure is like for that particular buck?
Where he was, you can only get to him by boat. Like there is no possible way to get to that deer any other way. And there's no boat launch there. So, I mean, you have to paddle downriver a couple of miles. When you're done, you have to paddle upriver a couple of miles. I mean, it sucks. Mm-hmm. I've ran a camera in there for 2 years and I've never had a person on that camera. Not that deer lives on that island specifically, but I mean, they can suck back into those spots and just all they have to do is bed down. You know, if you're 10 yards from that buck when they're in the cattails, you're never going to know that they're there.
Yeah,
but they can also make that mistake and, you know, take a right instead of a left, and they end up on an island that you can get to from the road that's 200 yards away. And I mean, that's when those deer get shot.
Yeah. Do you think that deer like that are swimming deep water on a daily basis?
Yes.
Okay.
100%. The amount of deer that I paddle past at night getting out of these places is hilarious.
Okay. Like
almost every day I will see deer swimming.
That blows my mind, right? And maybe I'm thinking about it all wrong and maybe it's my turkey approach, right? Like, have you ever tried to call a turkey across the river? I mean, it's not going to happen for the most part.
All you're doing is making noise and making yourself feel like you're in the game.
Exactly. But that tom's not going to just fly across the river, you know, especially if it's during the day. But for deer, it doesn't take anything for them to cross a 30-foot river. Or 40-foot river. You know what I mean? It's just jump in the river, swim a little bit, pop out on the other side. And so you feel like a lot of the deer back in there are doing that on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like I said, deer, I don't think they care about water. Like swimming across something, walking across a shallow section. Like we were duck hunting in Nebraska last year. And I mean, we saw half a dozen deer swim across the lake in one morning while we were.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't, and maybe it's because I don't hunt near a big enough body of water where they need to do that. Like the biggest body of water, these deer are probably coming up to the bottom of their brisket as far as depth is concerned. But for them, it's just a jump and they're across it. You know what I mean? It's not huge. I've heard and seen deer cross bigger rivers, but not anywhere that I've been hunting. So. It just kind of blows my mind that there's deer that's part of their bed to food rotation. You know what I mean? Yeah. Is it legal to shoot a deer out of the water while it's swimming?
Actually, don't know. I've never contemplated it. I don't know if it's legal to shoot out of a boat.
Yeah, I don't know. That's crazy. I've seen videos of dudes floating rivers and shooting deer out of a boat from a river. I've seen videos about it. I don't know what state it is when they do that.
I think I've watched the exact same video. I think that was in Michigan. Guys were floating in a canoe and shot a big one out of the boat.
Out of the boat. Like they were stood up. The deer was like, what is that thing floating down the river? Shot it. And yeah. Okay. So with that type of access, putting all your gear into a canoe, canoeing up and downstream, what are some of the biggest obstacles in that you have to face throughout that access route every year, I guess?
Yeah. I mean, new trees that are coming down, getting stuck in the river, trying to, you know, scoot your canoe over the top of a half sunken tree without flipping over.
Mm-hmm.
Just being able to pack enough gear with you without getting it all soaking wet. You know, it sucks to get in November and all of a sudden, you know, the bottom of your backpack is soaked and all your puffies are soaked. And just trying to get a deer out. You know, you have so much stuff packed in your canoe already to get in, and then you actually do shoot one, and now you have an extra 170 pounds of deer in there. It just makes everything so much harder.
Yeah. You do all of that solo, because like, it's not like another buddy can come in and help you. I mean, you could, but you'd have to travel your canoe back there, pick them up, and then come back. And then that's just that much more weight in the canoe, correct?
Yep. That's that much more weight. And then my buddies would have to know where I'm hunting.
Yeah. Oh, hell no. Right.
I don't know if you're this way, if you have close hunting buddies, but like, when me or a buddy calls each other for help to pack out a deer or whatever, like a black X goes on X on that spot. And now that's his area. I don't hunt it ever. And like we use that maliciously once in a while. Like you find a hot new area, you shoot one, you're like, oh, I got to call my buddy to come over here and get this. That way I know that he'll
Exactly. You can never hunt here again because I call it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We have some, it's not on like, I don't have anything like that on private or public, but we do have like unwritten rules, or at least the crew that I ran around with did, and that on private. And that was like, hey dude, if I'm hunting a piece of private, you do not go and talk to the landowner about that piece, right? Like it's off limits. Like it's just because in the past, there's been some times where I went to, you know, I knew a guy, and then my buddy got to know him. And then that guy then was like, oh yeah, if you want to hunt here too, you can. And then my buddy started hunting there. And I'm just like, yeah, he got permission. Yeah, he can legally be there. He's supposed to do that. But there's some like unwritten rules where you can and can't hunt back in the day. That's way harder now. So I would be way more lenient with, you know, with that rule compared to, you know, some of the, that was back when I had thousands of acres of permission to hunt. Now I don't have that. So yeah, dude. All right. So you're not very like, are there times where you're like only 6 feet off the ground, 6-7 feet off the ground, and you're just like shooting one opening?
Yeah. I wouldn't say a lot of the time. Generally, I'm trying to find those trees that I can get up a little ways, but I mean, I've been in a few spots, and like we talked on your other podcast, when I was in Nebraska last year, I mean, I was 8 feet up and the only tree that was in that area. And like, that's just that, that's your opportunity. You know, you can't hunt on the ground in those spots. Can't see 3 feet. If I get up 8 feet, at least I can, you know, have a 15 yard shot.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. So new trees dropping into the water, you trying to figure out new paths. What happens when the water's really low? Are you able to just walk it? Like, is there times when the canoe isn't working because the water's too low? Is that an issue as well?
Yeah, you'll see that on drought years. A lot of these sections of the river, you can just jump out, walk with the canoe for a few hundred yards, jump back into the canoe, paddle some more, walk some more. And where I was last year, it was 2.5 miles of paddling, then drag the canoe through 150 yards of cattails, get into another little channel, then paddle back some more. So it's always a different challenge and slightly different nightmare.
Yeah. How does the deer movement change on low water versus really high water?
They like swimming the river when they're super fast. Like I feel like in those low water years, and they just scoot across everything without a thought. When it's super, super fast, it's harder for them. Honestly, it's a lot harder for me as well. You know, you don't want to have a 4 mile an hour current that you're trying to paddle against, especially if you have a weighted down canoe.
Yeah, for sure. So I'm guessing there's times when you're pulling a deer out of there where paddling up current is a son of a bitch.
Yeah, it's not fun at all. I was doing it a couple of years ago behind another guy, and he had his two kids with him. So I'm sitting there watching three headlights paddling in front of me, and I'm like, God, I wish I had a friend right now.
Yeah. So help weigh the boat down, you mean?
Or just to help paddle against the crew.
Yeah, okay,
you know,
I got you.
You're doing all the work yourself, and you're like, man, what I would do to have a 9-year-old paddling in the front of my canoe.
Right, or an Evinrude on your canoe. So, all right. So what's like the go-to strategy when you're there? What are you looking for in these swamps that's going to help you get close to deer?
I mean, I don't think that the swamps are a whole lot different than any other sort of hardwoods. You know, you're trying to find just those transition areas that have heavy brush that's going out into some sort of daytime feed.
Yeah.
You know, during the rut, that doesn't matter nearly as much. But I mean, if you're trying to kill an early season buck, like you need to be able to get close enough to his bedroom without screwing it up getting there. I mean, that's where that water access with a canoe that's super quiet really lends itself to you.
Yeah. Are you, you know, for years, Dan Infault would talk about hunting a specific bed, like almost getting up in a tree where there's been a bed decades that deer were bedding in this one spot. Do you ever hunt specific beds?
I never really have. I mean, I know that there's a few areas around because in these swamps, you'll have a tree or two and that root ball will get big enough where a buck can bed in there.
Mm-hmm.
So I do know where a few of those are, but I've never tried to specifically hunt a bed like that. I'm generally trying to find big community scrapes back in these spots.
Okay. With the water, you know, water means that a deer's not bedding there, right? Mm-hmm. Does it become predictable over time to know where deer are bedding to where you know where you can, where you need to be versus where you can't go?
Yeah, 100%. Like I said, they don't bed in water. So the more time you spend in these swamps finding these small high spots, like I said, the does will bed on those islands. I have never really seen it where bucks are bedding on these bigger oak islands or these bigger open flats. Like they're in the little hidey holes. So knowing where those are is pretty important. But again, like I said, if you look on any map or any decent aerial, like you can see the trails running from these little pockets. And even if you can't tell that it's a higher spot from the map, like if you see 9 different trails running into this one section and then blasting out the other side, it's like, well, there's something there that they care about.
Right, right. Yeah, that makes sense. So they become predictable. And then obviously if they're predictable, do you see a lot of adjustment to their movement every single year? Or are they taking those same trails every single year? I mean, is it that predictable to where you can go back in there and be like, hey, listen, on this week, the rut's kicking off. I need to be in there on this wind and on this morning hunt, and I'm going to get a crack at something.
They generally are that predictable unless something in the area changes. You know,
like water versus low water.
High water versus low water. If the ag that the does are feeding in changes. I had a spot a couple of years ago with just a big community scrape and actually pretty easy spot to get into. That was great. Had a camera on it all year, had probably 15 to 20 different bucks that were hitting this one scrape. And the week before the season, I had a big 8-pointer up on his hind legs on the licking branch and he snapped my licking branch off. And then it went downhill from there. I put a rope-a-dope's kit on it.
Mm-hmm.
Kept the deer coming in. It was fine. And then during Wisconsin rifle season, one of my fellow awesome hunters in Wisconsin tore the entire tree out when he walked past it. And I'm like, oh, sweet. And I ran a camera there all year last year. And I mean, didn't have a single decent buck on it. I'm like, all right, well, this spot is completely dead now.
Yeah. So what do you do when that water's too high and comes above where traditionally deer are bedding then? Do you just avoid that spot and go find them for example, my father-in-law hunts the Mississippi River, or excuse me, he fishes the Mississippi River. If the water's 8 foot versus 15 foot and everything in between, he knows where the fish are going to be, right? And so whether it's low water or high water, he's got spots over his 45 years of fishing the Mississippi River. Have you collected those types of spots in the areas where you hunt, where if the water's high or above this point, I know that it's pointless for me to go back there, or I need to get to my plan B spot or C spot?
Not really. I mean, these deer, regardless of how deep the water is in a lot of this, they're going to run the same trails. You know, those dry spots are going to be less, so mm-hmm. we'll concentrate where they're bedding a little bit more. What I've seen more than anything, though, is the deeper the water, the less people I have to ever deal with.
Okay. So you don't mind
likes wearing waders.
Right. But you don't mind it.
No. It just means that there's that many less people. The downside is the people that are back there know what they're doing. Like, yeah. they're the ones putting in the effort to get back there. Those aren't the people that I really want hunting the same spots as me.
How often do you get into a spot where you've had to load your canoe a mile or so, get into a tree, and then you see another canoe pull up, or you see a headlights coming up from the backside of where you're at?
Person walking on me last year for the entire season, and I never walked in on a single guy. So that doesn't happen very often.
Yeah. But when you're putting that much energy into your access route and going, like, number one, you have to have a canoe or a boat. Number two, you have to be willing to paddle that canoe. You have to be willing to walk through standing water in the thickest areas possible, get through there, and then set up. And then potentially, I don't know, like, how many deer in a given sit are you seeing?
All depends on the area. I mean, generally, 2 to 3 deer a night is pretty good for a lot of these spots. You know, they're not super high concentration areas. It's just you're hunting a specific pinch point for a reason.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. All right. Tell me a story about a time you were successful, given what we've already talked about, given the, you know, like the canoe, the sat, you know, like the waders, all that stuff. Let me hear your favorite story about hunting in those conditions.
Been a couple of years since I've killed one, and in a back spot like that. It's actually the spot that I referenced with that big licking branch. You know, it's a spot that it's CRP grass, cattails, kind of misery to get back to. It's about a mile and a half walk, but you have to walk it in hip boots all the way back. I had hunted it opening day that year, and I sat dark to dark opening day, which is misery. I mean, it was 17 yeah. hours in my tree stand.
Yeah.
Saw 13 different bucks opening day. One of the best deer hunts that I've ever had. Didn't end up shooting a deer opening day, and actually had to wait all the way until November to get back there. But got in for an all-day sit again, and it was, I want to say, 8 or 9 a.m. You could hear the deer in the cattails. And I don't know if you've had the experience where you can hear a deer for 45 minutes grunting and chasing and never see it.
Boy.
But you're just sitting there shaking like a leaf. You're like, holy shit, it's going to work. It's going to happen. Yeah. But it just takes forever. So, I mean, you're already wound tight by the time you see anything. And this was a case where I watched the deer swim across a creek channel. Watch the doe come through, and I'm like, all right, well, this is going to be my chance. He's going to come out right there. And sure enough, the deer right behind me here pops out, swims across the creek channel, and stands at 23 yards broadside trying to figure out where his doe went, who was 3 yards directly underneath me, and was able to put a decent shot on. It was actually the loudest hit I've ever heard. What was I shooting back then? I think I was shooting Full Metal Jackets on a like a 2.3 inch Rage or something.
Yeah.
And I shot through it and I hit the opposite side ball joint.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched my arrow hit and shoot back towards me.
No shit.
And I'm like, what in the world was that? But I mean, it just, you know, tenoring that ball joint, which, I mean, no broadhead is going to break that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it just shot right back at me. And yeah, getting it out of there, I mean, where I found it, it was above knee-deep water in the cattails, and it was just absolute misery trying to pull that buck out.
How long did it take you to get that, from when the time you found him to the time you got him back to your truck, how long did that take? Holy shit.
Yeah.
Holy cow. That's bananas, having to drag a deer through a swamp for that long.
Yeah, I mean, every part of it sucks, but that's why those deer survive in that. Dude. You know, we live in a state where you have to drag them out.
Yeah.
I don't know. In Iowa, are you able to quarter and pack deer, or you have to drag out there?
Drag the whole animal out. Yep. And that's cool, dude. I mean, you're sitting in your comfy house right now, right? You look at that deer and you go, the amount of hell that I had to go through to get, number one, get to this deer, and then drag him out took me 5 hours. Holy smokes, dude.
That's that type two fun.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a story, man. It's something that just gets me hyped up when someone's, when I hear stories like that. It's like, yeah, it took me, like, how long did the walk into that stand location take in those conditions?
Sorry, you broke up there, Dan.
Yeah. How long did it take for you to walk from your truck to that stand location through the water?
It's about an hour walk.
Okay. Hour walk in, set, shoot the deer, you know, and then a 5 hour drag out. Bananas. Like, but that's the story, right? It's like, hey, listen, here's, you tell that story and hey, tell me the story about that buck. Okay. Here's how it went down. Dude, no, like deer, most people do not work. I would even guess like 90% of people do not work that hard to kill deer like that. That's why a majority of people, like, I don't want to say a majority, but that's why people plant food plots and hunt out of box blinds and they wait for the deer to come to them and they can pull their side by side right up to it and pop it up. I'm not saying that that's, you know, right or wrong or anything. I'm just saying, like, to hear that story and the amount of effort and your heart rate getting up like really high on that drag out, it's, I don't know. I like stories like that is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. And that's just, it makes that hunt so special because it was, and not saying anything bad about the guys hunting private land and box blinds and everything, but like, it's such a different experience when there's so much extra misery that you put yourself through to get that same caliber deer that the guys, you know, drive the side-by-side up to, throw it in, or drive up to it with the tractor and put it in the loader.
Yep.
Go back to camp and crack a beer, where like, by the time I get back to the truck, like, I just want to grab a Gatorade and take a nap.
Yeah, I just want to pass out. Love it. Aaron, dude, excellent story. Excellent conversation today, man. I needed one of those, because usually what we're doing these days is trying to find something to make everything easier, right? And aside from the trail camera part of this, where like, we talk about putting trail cameras in specific spots and then leaving them alone. What you're doing is what dudes have been doing for a long time, like working hard to get deer, right? Not making necessarily trying to make it easier, but putting in the extra effort to get to the deer. So great conversation, man. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day to hop on again. And thank you very much. And good luck this upcoming season, man.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Dan. It's always fun talking to you.